Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. What a time to be in our nation's capital. As talk of impeachment accelerates, we're coming to you live this morning from NPR in Washington for a special live broadcast. We'll talk with NPR's one-time White House correspondent about what it's like covering the Donald Trump administration. And we'll also get a tour of three of D.C.'s most well-known museums that experts say are still hidden gems. Scott Horsley is NPR's chief economics correspondent, which means he keeps close tabs on what appears to be an ever-evolving, confounding national financial picture. How strong is the economy? And is a recession on the horizon? What about a deal to end the standoff with China? And what does he make of all this impeachment talk? We'll also talk with Scott about the decade he spent on the White House beat and his coverage of the presidential campaigns of folks like John McCain and Mitt Romney. And what about the bike ride he participates in each year? That's the only bike ride in America where the riders actually gain weight. We're about to run down all of this. It's a pleasure to have Scott Horsley with us as we come to you live this morning from the mothership. That's NPR in Washington. Scott, welcome back. It's always great to have you here.
Steve, it's great to be with you. And as you said, what a time to be in Washington.
What a time to be here. And let's talk about that and the big news today. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said the House of Representatives would begin formal impeachment proceedings against President Trump. The House Intelligence Committee met just this morning in hearings that were televised nationally and on KCUR. There are a lot of moving parts here. Maybe the question is, how much trouble is the president in as we sit here this morning? What's your sense?
You know, Steve, it's kind of a moving target. This
Absolutely.
Is a story that has really gone from 0 to 60 or 0 to 600 in really the space of a week. This morning, the Intelligence Committee released the unclassified version of the whistleblower's initial complaint about President Trump. This is a complaint that was written back in the middle of August. And it was cleared to be forwarded to the intelligence committees in late August by the Inspector General of the intelligence community. But the acting Director of National Intelligence, with the help of the Justice Department, pretty much succeeded in bottling this whole thing up for the first few weeks of September. You know, the first most of us knew about this was only about a week ago when these words started coming that there was an outstanding complaint that hadn't been forwarded to the intelligence committees. And now, in just the space of the last 48 hours, we've had the actual transcript of this telephone call, or the rough transcript of a phone call between the president and the Ukrainian leader made public, and then today the actual complaint from the whistleblower. So it's accelerated very fast. That's what's brought folks like Congresswoman Davids on board, and that's a big deal. When you have lawmakers from swing districts,
Absolutely.
Formerly Republican districts, who are willing to take the plunge and say, yes, we ought to pursue this. And it was only, you know, within the last week that we've seen a lot of those centrist Democrats come out and take that stand. That's what's brought us to this point.
You know, Scott, just one more thing on this impeachment proceeding, this talk today. The narrative, at least from a Democratic standpoint, appears to have shifted to a new word. And it's one that you've mentioned here, cover up. How significant is that?
Well, the old saw in Washington, of course, is it's not the crime, it's the cover-up that is one's undoing. Yesterday, when President Trump was talking about those notes or that rough transcript of his call with the Ukrainian leader, he said what he said before, which is that it's a perfect call. There was nothing in there that was a problem for him. And he may very well feel that way, because this is a president who pretty much feels like if I do it, it must be right. But what we learned today from this complaint that the whistleblower wrote was that people within the White House, when that call was made back in the middle of July, took steps to move the records of that call from the sort of standard computer system where they would ordinarily be kept into a more secret, a more out of sight electronic filing system. In other words, while the president might not have seen anything wrong with what had transpired in that call, there were people within the White House who said, this is radioactive. We better put this out of sight. Now, whether that goes anywhere, we'll see. But that's kind of what's the focus of a lot of the talk today.
Well, let's move now to your work as NPR's chief economics correspondent. You know, I can't help but wonder, Scott, what kind of impact will the House's impeachment inquiry have on the economy? The markets are down today significantly. What would you expect going forward?
You know, yesterday when this kind of came to a head, the markets, they were very volatile, but they ended pretty much flat as the markets were kind of taking this in stride. The likelihood of the president actually being removed from office while there's a Republican Senate to watch his back seems very low. So the markets are certainly not worried about a real change in personnel at the White House. I think the bigger question is, you know, how much of a mess does this make of policymaking? What does it mean for things like efforts to ratify the new NAFTA agreement?
Right.
What does it mean for the actual working of government? Does it gum up, you know, spending agreements? Does it gum up the actual machinery of government?
There's a lot of split opinion on all those questions right now.
That's right. I mean, just yesterday we saw the president getting kind of an argument with his own trade representative. Donald Trump was saying, while this impeachment process is playing out, there's no chance that we're going to actually ratify the new NAFTA accord. His trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, who's put a tremendous amount of work into that accord, was not so dismissive. He said, no, I think we can still get it done. And House Speaker Pelosi said today she still thinks they can get the new NAFTA ratification process is moving forward. Obviously, that's important in places like Kansas City.
You're
on the NAFTA superhighway.
Yeah.
You know, right at the midsection there between Mexico and Canada. Lots of that commerce moves. Now, if it kind of depends on, you know, what the alternative is. If you say, is it old NAFTA or new NAFTA? You know, getting new NAFTA done would make a difference, but not that big a difference. But the threat is, if you don't get the new NAFTA ratified, does the president unwind the old NAFTA? That would be really disruptive to the U.S. economy, not only in Kansas City, but all over the country. And yesterday, the president was asked about that, and he refused to rule out the possibility of unwinding the old NAFTA. So that threat's kind of looming out there. I don't think the market's taking it very seriously, but if that were to happen, you'd see real trouble in the economy.
What's the most significant thing, Scott, about the new NAFTA that our listeners should be aware of?
You know, the new NAFTA doesn't really make that big a change to the old NAFTA. It does update the trade agreement, the 1994 trade agreement, for things like the internet, which were barely in existence back then. It does sort of bring in a whole lot of stuff about digital commerce. So there's an updating part of it. But the biggest impact probably in this country is it does raise the bar for how much of an automobile in particular has to be made in high-wage places like the United States or Canada as opposed to Mexico. We've seen a fair amount of the auto automaking business shift south of the border since NAFTA went into effect. Wages in Mexico are still a lot lower than they are in the United States, and productivity in Mexico is now pretty much comparable to what it is in the United States. So the automakers have shifted a lot of their production south of the border. NAFTA tries to move some of that back, or at least prevent more of it from the new NAFTA, I should say, tries to move some of that back or prevent more of it from going south. But other than that, it's probably not a huge difference between new NAFTA and old NAFTA, but the difference between new or old NAFTA and pre-NAFTA is very large.
NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley is my guest as we come to you live from NPR in Washington. What's your sense, Scott, of where the economy is headed these days? Because you can't help but almost get whiplash trying to keep track of the daily reports, which seem to contradict each other day after day.
Well, there are somewhat mixed signals, but I think here's what we can say. The U.S. economy is still growing. It hasn't slipped into recession, but it is definitely growing more slowly now than it was, say, at the beginning of the year. We just got confirmation today from the Commerce Department that second quarter growth, that is growth in April, May, and June of this year, was about an annual pace of 2%. That's down from 3.1% in the first 3 months of the year. And that's probably about what we're looking at in the current quarter as well, somewhere around 2%. So overall for the year, we're going to be sort of in the soft twos. We're not going to make 3% growth. I think that's very unlikely we'll have 3% growth this year. And of course, that's something that President Trump has promised is 3% growth.
But so 2% ain't nothing.
It ain't nothing. And what's really happening there is it's almost kind of a two-speed economy. You've got the consumer economy, which is still holding up pretty strong, and consumer spending accounts for a huge portion of the overall economy. Consumers are still spending pretty healthily. Not surprising, because we've got low unemployment, we've got modest wage growth,
right.
So people have money, they're feeling pretty good, they're spending money. But then you have businesses which are feeling a lot more shaky. Business investment has dropped off rather sharply since the beginning of the year, and part of that is a reaction to all the trade conflicts that have been underway, as well as slowing growth in other parts of the world. This has been particularly hard on the manufacturing sector, which is especially sensitive. They're more export-driven. Mm-hmm. They're more sensitive to what's going on around the world, as opposed to, you know, the service economy, which tends to rely mostly on kind of local domestic customers, not quite so sensitive. So you can kind of pick your indicator and find some that look a little rosier, some that look a little worse. But on balance, I think what we should say is the U.S. economy is still growing, but at a slower pace than it was.
You know, just the other day, Scott, you reported on a story that has very strong implications back in the Kansas City area, and that's the UAW strike against GM. You pointed out that there was a time when a strike at GM would send shockwaves throughout the economy, but those days are long gone. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the fundamental thing is that GM employs about 10% of the people it did back in the late 70s. At their peak, General Motors employed more than half a million workers in this country. Today, it's about 50,000. So that's obviously a big change. And that's against a bigger base. So, you know, 50,000 out of a bigger pool of workers. Certainly don't want to minimize the effect of the strike and the hardship that means for the people who work in those plants who are suddenly getting strike pay as opposed to their really robust paycheck, and for the communities right around there. But it is not the huge dagger in the heart of the U.S. economy like it once was. It was kind of fun putting that piece together. We went back and looked at, you know, the history of the UAW and GM, which really grew up together throughout the 20th century. And we had some old archival tape of Walter Cronkite talking about a big strike in 1970. And when it ended, he said, you know, this ends a strike that's been imperiling the U.S. economy for nearly 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the coverage of this strike, it's certainly gotten some coverage, but no one other than the workers directly affected and the parts suppliers who were indirectly affected is really on the edge of their seat saying, are we going to settle it today? Are we going to settle it today?
You know, I'm wondering about the difference between covering the economy compared to covering the White House. How has your life changed? Because you used to be on point 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah,
right?
that's the biggest change. You know, I'm still working pretty much full time, but I can
pretty much
I can plan my day a little bit more than I could covering, in particular the Trump White House, which was very unpredictable. I'd covered all 8 years of the Obama White House, and that was unpredictable in its own way. But the last 2.5 years of under the President Trump were even more unpredictable. And you never knew when you came in the morning, you know, when is my day going to end? On the business beat, it's a little more predictable, but you certainly still get surprises thrown at you.
Right.
You know, things do happen, not always between 9 and 5, and so we still try to stay on top of things.
You know, I'm sure you've been asked this question a zillion times, but the difference between covering President Obama and President Trump, what is it?
night and day.
Day, yeah.
Now, it was particularly night and day from the last couple of years of the Obama administration and the first two of the Trump administration. If you go back to the beginning of the Obama administration, that was also a pretty wild roller coaster ride.
The economy was in peril.
The economy was in free fall. We didn't know, talking about General Motors, whether General Motors was going to live or die. Same with Chrysler. It was as everybody who came into the story at that time said, like drinking out of a fire hose. More news happened in the first 6 months of the Obama administration than, you know, you typically get in a four-year term. By the last couple of years of the administration, obviously things had settled down, slowed down a good bit. It was much more of a sort of orderly orderly process. The first days of the Trump administration were anything but orderly. I remember the very first Friday that the president was in office when the White House put out the first version of their quote-unquote Muslim ban. And, you know, we were just trying to figure out which countries is this going to apply to. And a young press aide said, hey, your guess is as good as mine. So it was a very seat-of-the-pants policymaking in the early days of the Trump administration and probably right up until the present.
Scott Horsley of NPR is my guest. You know, I've been told, you know, those of us on the outside looking in to someone who covers the White House, we tend to view that beat as the absolute glamour beat of all time. And then you hear from people on the inside who actually do it, and maybe it's not quite as glamorous, Scott, or
how
would you
tell you about the mouse traps in our booth over there?
Is that right?
we haven't caught one in a while.
In the White House?
That's good news.
Yeah.
It is absolutely an exciting opportunity. I wouldn't trade those 10 years I spent on the beat for anything. It was a front row seat to a lot of history, or really kind of a back row seat. I was usually somewhere behind the camera riser, but still a window on history. But there's also lots of tedium, you know, lots of sitting around in vans and lots of hurry up and wait kind of stuff,
too. Because you're sort of trapped in the basement there, right? You can't go out and walk through the White House and interview people like you could if you were covering City Hall like your sister did back in Kansas City.
Absolutely. Or even my colleagues on Capitol Hill here, they have tremendous freedom to sort of roam the halls. We're herded into a pretty small corral there at the White House. And when you're on the road, I got to see a lot of different countries traveling with both President Obama and President Trump. But you're sort of rushing through. I call it a poo-poo platter. You get a glimpse of lots of famous places and interesting places that you might want to go back to and sample at greater leisure at another time.
Yeah. I'm told that President Obama really got a kick out of your mother's zucchini bread.
Well, I knew that President Obama liked zucchini bread because he'd ordered some from a bakery once at the West Side Market in Cleveland, and I, of course, my mom made fantastic zucchini bread, and so the Obama campaign was passing through Colorado in 2012, and my mom came out to visit me, and she brought me a loaf of her homemade zucchini bread. I can't imagine what the security people thought when she came through with this tinfoil wrapped brick, but they let her through into the press area. And I brought the zucchini bread back on the airplane to share with some of my press colleagues. And President Obama happened to come back into the press cabin just at that moment. And since I knew he liked zucchini bread, I said, "Mr. President, would you like a piece of zucchini bread?" He said, "Sure." And he took a bite, said, "That's great. That's great zucchini bread." I said, "My mom made that." He said, "I'm going to have to write her a note." So he did. He wrote her a nice thank you note.
I bet that still holds a place of some honor in your mom's household there. Do you get a chance to know these people? I mean, people, you're spending so much time covering the president. Do you get a feel for who they are?
You know, I don't pretend that I have any special insight into either Barack Obama or Donald Trump as an individual, but I spend a lot of time watching at least the public side of them. Mm-hmm. And you know, to whatever extent they let their hair down when they were in the presence of reporters, which was not a lot, less for President Obama than President Trump. But neither of them, you know, is completely at ease when they know that the reporters are watching. But if you watch them, you know, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, you certainly get some insight at least into what their public persona is.
You know, when you have those two-way conversations with a Steve Inskeep or a Rachel Martin, how much of that is scripted for you, and how much of that are you ad-libbing in front of a national audience of several million people?
It depends on the story. If it's a kind of a complicated story and one with a lot of, you know, facts and figures in it, I will sometimes try to script it out so I can deliver a lot of information in the most clear way possible. If it's something that just sprung up and as has happened, you know, when Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, I found out about it before he did. I got a wake-up call at 5 a.m. I'm told he wasn't woken up till 6 a.m. Eastern time. But I got a wake-up call at 5 and was on the air at 6. There wasn't really much time to script anything out there. So that I was kind of winging it that day. today.
And sometimes when you broadcast from your home, I'm told by insider sources that you've got dogs in the background that you've got to worry about, right?
I have had a couple of occasions when my dogs Rufus and Rosie have had unscheduled cameos on Morning Edition. I'm in good company there, though. You know, last week, of course, we lost one of our founding mothers here at NPR, Cokie Roberts, and right. It was Cokie's beagle Abner that kind of paved the way for all of those not-so-silent four-legged friends, because Cokie used to do her Monday morning segments from home, and Abner occasionally made his way onto the air. So if it's good enough for Cokie and Abner, it's good enough for Rufus and Rosie.
You know, Scott, a couple of things before you go. Campaign coverage, you've done a whole lot of it. I don't know if a lot of listeners understand just how arduous that work is with all the early morning baggage calls and the like. I mean, you don't get a lot of sleep when you're covering a presidential campaign.
No, that's true. It's a lot of long days and short nights and early mornings and a lot of time on buses and planes and vans. But it is also, if you can rub the sleep out of your eyes, a really inspiring way to sort of see our country, especially in the waning days of a campaign. You know, in a rainy April morning a year out, it's not necessarily all that inspiring. But when you get to the end of a campaign, the last month or 2 months, when the crowds are really excited and everyone's really focused,
there's an energy there, isn't there?
And I've been on covering losing campaigns and covering winning campaigns, and in both cases, you know, even if the candidates go on to lose, their supporters were very excited to see them and excited about the whole prospect of our democratic government. And that's, every so often you kind of have to pinch yourself and say, you know, that's still something pretty special. If you're standing at an outdoor rally on a crisp October evening, yeah, and the sky is clear and it's a nice night,
I've
and
had
you've got
that experience
10,000
too.
People who are just there to be a part of our government, that's pretty special.
Just before you go, what's the latest on the trade war with China and whether Americans can expect some resolution there anytime soon, including lots of farmers back in Missouri and Kansas?
Yeah, I know this has been a huge concern. I'll just say that farmers did get a little break yesterday with a mini trade deal that the U.S. carved out with Japan. Beef pork producers in particular have been at a disadvantage in Japan since Trump pulled out of the TPP and competitors in places like Australia and New Zealand have been getting lower tariff rates there. So that's a good thing. China, of course, another major farm export market. We've seen a little bit of a thaw just, I think, yesterday or overnight. We got word of some sizable, not enormous, but sizable soybean purchases from China. That's helped soybean prices tick up just a little bit today. Price are still hurting there because the Chinese market has been kind of off limits. The next step is China's representatives are going to be here in Washington early next month, in just a couple weeks, for the next round of talks, and we'll see where they go. Then mid-October, we are on track to see an increase in tariff rates here from 25% to 30% on some $250 billion worth of Chinese imports. And there's another round of tariffs set to kick in mid-December. So, you know, we'll see if they can make a deal and maybe forestall those tariff increases and those new tariffs.
Right.
Otherwise, by the end of this year, you're going to be looking at pretty steep tariffs on just about everything we buy from China.
That's Scott Horsley. He's NPR's chief economics correspondent, taking time with us here from NPR in Washington. Scott, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Always enjoy your reports. Thanks
very much.
Great to
be with you. Thanks so much.
When we come back, we'll talk about this idea that there's a museum for everybody here in Washington. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR Kansas City. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske, coming to you live from Washington today. Get my perspective on the topics we discuss every day here on the show in my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. And you'll also get highlights of the work the Up-to-Date team does each week. That's kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, a panel of journalists who first covered Missouri, then made the move to the nation's capital, will learn about making that transition and find out how they tell the stories from Washington that they do for audiences back home. Well, out here in Washington, they sometimes say there's a museum for everyone. Now, a look at three museums that are well-known, but maybe not quite as well-known as, say, the Air and Space Museum or the National Gallery of Art. But some folks call these museums hidden gems and places well worth a visit next time you're in the nation's capital. With us, Vince Houghton is an historian and curator for the International Spy Museum. Vince, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for being here.
Daniel Piazza is the chief curator for the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning.
Catherine Keene is vice president of public experiences for the National Geographic Society. She's also executive director of the National Geographic Museum. Catherine, good morning to you.
Pleasure.
Well, tell me one thing, Catherine, that's really cool at each of your museums. Light us up here a little bit. What gets you at the National Geographic Museum?
Well, the National Geographic Society was founded in Washington, D.C., so the museum is embedded in the world headquarters, and it is an opportunity for people who read National Geographic, watch us on television, have followed the stories that we've been telling for over 130
years, to connect in a way,
to come and experience the institution in a special way.
Vince, how about the Spy Museum?
We have the largest collection of espionage artifacts on public display anywhere in the world.
Like what? What does that mean, espionage artifacts?
Sure, everything from the ice axe that killed Leon Trotsky back in Mexico City, the real one, to things created by CIA, KGB, MI6, all agencies around the world. One-of-a-kind railroad artifacts that you're not going to see anywhere else.
How do you get that stuff?
Well, some of it was acquired the old-fashioned way of stealing it from places that didn't want to give it to
you. That's what spies do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Some of it from private collectors, some of it from agencies. We have great relationships as a 501c3 with the intelligence agencies around the world. And in some cases, they lend us artifacts. But in some cases, it was shoved down somebody's pants in Moscow and smuggled out. And I won't get into specifically who or what. But
you're not going to give anybody up right now, right?
No, not right now.
Yeah. Daniel, how about the Smithsonian National Postal Museum?
Well, I'm always partial to our postage stamp collection. It's what drew me to the museum in the first place as a stamp collector since I was a child.
Is that right?
We have about 6 million stamps in our collection.
So six million?
Yeah, one of the largest stamp collections, institutional stamp collections in the world.
And people can come see them?
Well, not all 6 million of them, but quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
Most of them are in storage, but you can make appointments to see whatever's not on display.
Hey, how are they on display, the stamps?
They're displayed in a variety of different ways. Some of the gems are in sort of very low light level cases to preserve them from fading and environmental damage and so forth. But the vast majority of them are in these more than 400 pullout frames, which are sort of like vertical drawers. And you can just spend all day pulling them out, looking at stamps from every country on earth and every time period in American history.
When I was a kid, I learned about the most maybe famous stamp ever, the one with the airplane turned upside down is the misprint that became such a valuable thing to own. Do you have one of those?
The Inverted Jenny of 1918.
Is
we
that,
have,
that what it is?
I believe, seven of them on display at the moment.
No kidding.
A block of four and three singles. Some of them are on loan to us. They don't all belong to the museum, but you can see seven of them in our gallery.
You know, I'm wondering about connections to the Kansas City area at each of your museums. Daniel, I'm guessing at the National Postal Museum, you deal with the Pony Express, which, of course, had its origins in the Kansas City area, St. Joseph. What do you have there from the Pony Express?
The Pony Express, you know, is one of those remarkable things. It was incredibly short-lived. It lasted less than about 18 months.
That's right.
But it has such a lore and a magic and history that surrounds it. So we have several pieces of mail that were carried by the Pony Express for the brief period that it operated in 1860 and 61.
Huh.
And those are on display.
Vince, did spies ever make their way out to Kansas and Missouri?
Always. Spies are everywhere. And I think that if you broaden it out to Missouri versus just Kansas City, I mean, you have everything from Harry Truman, who created the CIA in 1947. He was the president that creates the agency. To things like St. Louis, where there's actually a very good museum in St. Louis. It's the Western Museum of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So NGA West is actually in St. Louis. So if you want to kind of take a quick trip over there.
Huh.
But I mean, intelligence officers, anywhere there's something important. And throughout Missouri, there are certainly military bases. There are weapons facilities that you may not know about. There are places that are important to other countries. And if there are places important to other countries, there's going to be spies on hand to try to steal that information. So even though you think you might be from a small town somewhere, you're inextricably linked to worldwide espionage, whether you like it or not.
Catherine, how about the National Geographic Museum? Any connections to the Kansas City area there?
Well, the magazine I'm sure, has done many stories over the years on Missouri and Kansas and all the other states in the U.S. as well.
And Candace Millard, one of our best-selling authors, used to work at your place.
That's right. That's correct. But I have an even more interesting and somewhat timely connection for your listeners, which is that we just closed an exhibition called The Queens of Egypt, which is on its way to the Nelson Atkins Museum opening in November. So this incredible exhibition about antiquity from Egypt related to the life of the queens, and in particular Queen Nefertari, who is Ramses the Great's queen. So it's a wonderful blockbuster exhibition that just closed here.
I was going to say, how popular did it prove to be?
It was really popular, one of our most popular exhibits ever. So it should do very well in Kansas City. And so we're sending Egypt to you.
Well, we appreciate that. Thank you very much. I wonder if each of you could give us some history of your museums and maybe a sense of how they came about and why they came about to begin with. Vince, how about the Spy Museum? What gave birth to that?
So our founder spent almost a year in the National Security Agency during Korea. He was a member of the Navy, and he got chucked over to an agency no one had ever heard of called NSA, and then kind of got the bug. And then later on in life, he had earned a lot of money in private industry. He'd opened museums, helped to open things like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, and several other museums, and decided in the 1990s that the country was ready for a museum focused on intelligence. And so the concept started in the 90s, and then we opened in 2002. Now, of course, in the middle of that was the attacks of 9/11, which took a relatively obscure subject in spying and made it, put it on the front page of every newspaper on earth every single day. Mm-hmm. And so a great idea in the 1990s became an important idea in the 2000s, because most people don't understand a lot of what's going on in the intelligence world. It's not something you learn in school, right?
Right.
But it's so important to understand if we're going to be good citizens, if we're going to be part of this country and effectively be an oversight agency, which we are as people. You know, when we send members of Congress to Congress.
Well, how do you treat the 2001 attacks in the nation's capital and in New York? Because a lot of folks thought that was a failure of national intelligence.
And the story of 9/11 is in a gallery called Fateful Failures. We look at that as a failure. We don't blame anyone, really. We try to deconstruct it, try to get to the kind of the anatomy of a failure, because it's very similar to what happened in 1941 in Pearl Harbor, the surprise attack against Hawaii. And we try to show, why did we make the mistakes and some of the same mistakes that we did decades apart? Mm. And it turns out it's a lot of things that happen all the time in intelligence. And it's because it's really, really hard to provide what we call strategic warning. And if you're very good at it, you stop a bad thing from happening. And then everyone thinks that you're Chicken Little because nothing bad happens, but you've been yelling about something bad happening. And if you're bad at it, it's all over the front page of every newspaper on earth. Huh. And so it's not a very, there's not a lot of thanks that you get for doing this job.
Wow. How about the Postal Museum and what gave birth to that, Daniel?
Well, the Postal Museum is one of the Smithsonian Institution's museums in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And the museum itself opened to the public in 1993. But the Smithsonian Institution had been collecting stamps and objects related to the mail for over a century before that. Smithsonian started collecting those things in the 1880s.
And you just needed a place to put all that good stuff.
Right. So for many years, people who visited Washington, D.C. years and years ago will remember that this collection was formerly at the American History Museum on the Mall on the third floor, you know, and in other buildings around Washington, D.C., but it's been with us since 1993.
How much traffic does the Postal Museum get compared to some of the other Smithsonian museums?
We see about 500,000 visitors a year at the National Postal Museum. So we're on one of the busiest street corners in Washington, D.C., right next door to Union Station. So that helps with our visibility, I think, foot traffic. And people say, oh, Postal Museum, what is that? And they go in and look around.
And the Air and Space draws how many?
Oh, they frequently state that they're one of the most heavily visited museums in the world. I don't know the exact figure, but yeah, Air and Space, the Louvre, they're all right up there as the most heavily trafficked museums in the world.
Yeah. Catherine, what gave birth to the National Geographic Society Museum?
Well, National Geographic is a nonprofit organization, which I don't think a lot of people realize. Mm-hmm. It was founded to fund exploration and education, geographic education, back in the 19th century. So in many ways, the museum and the exhibits that we do are just an extension of that educational mission. But the magazine and the society has always sort of been a membership organization as well. So the people that subscribe to the magazine, they feel like they are part of the organization. So this idea of inviting them into the mothership, to the world headquarters, to experience some of the content in our 15 million image archive has always been a part of the vision of the founders. So it's been around for a long time.
There's such an aura around the National Geographic Society, the history, the explorers that were funded through your society. I mean, that tradition, that aura seems to continue, at least it does in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think in many ways you could tell the story of the 20th century through the National Geographic Archive and the stories that we've told from every corner of the earth for over a century now. So we want you to feel at the museum like you're walking into the pages of National Geographic, but also learn a little bit about the nonprofit work that we do.
Yeah,
and be inspired.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're coming to you live this morning from NPR headquarters in Washington. We're talking with representatives from three museums here in Washington, well-known but maybe not as well-known as some of the big ones like the Air and Space Museum. We're visiting with Vince Houghton with the International Spy Museum, Daniel Piazza from the National Postal Museum, and Catherine Keene with the National Geographic Museum. You know, how have your museums changed over the years, Daniel, in terms of technology, presentation, the themes you explore with the exhibits? I mean, there's been this whole push in the museum world to make things more interactive. How have you adjusted with the times there?
About 6 years ago, we opened a new gallery on the street level of our museum that incorporated a lot of originally produced videos that helped walk visitors through the process of how stamps are created and used and collected, and those sorts of topics and themes. A lot of hands-on activities where they can actually see or manipulate parts of printing presses, feel some of the equipment that's used to create, perforate, and print stamps and those sorts of things. So I think a combination of both electronic and tactile interactives are really, some mix in there is really the best. It is a little easy, I think, to go overboard on the electronic and digital interactives.
Is stamp collecting today as popular as it used to be when we were kids?
I think it is, but I think it's done differently today than maybe it was in the past. I think more people pursue it individually through the internet and using their computers. They may not necessarily belong to stamp clubs the way they used to in the past. Stamp clubs and publications all talk frequently about declines in membership, but I don't think that equates to a lack of interest in the subject or in the collecting aspect of it. I just think people are doing it differently now than they did in the past.
Are there more stamps to buy when you walk in the post office than there used to be? There's been this explosion of commemorative stamps and different strains of stamps that have come out over the years.
I think that's right. There's been an explosion, not just in the number of stamps, but also I think in the diversity of the themes and the topics that they commemorate. So there's been a real push over the last decade or two on the part of the Postal Service, I think, to more broadly commemorate parts of our national life and shared experience.
Yeah. Vince, how about the Spa Museum? How have you guys kept up with the times?
Well, it's an interesting question. We just reopened the Spy Museum in May. We moved from our original location where we'd been for 16 years in the center part of D.C. To a brand new building, just reopened in May. It's entirely different than the old museum.
Why did you get a new building?
Well, because we ran out of space, really, in the old one. We were in historic buildings that we couldn't do anything to, and we needed to be able to tell the stories better. We needed to be able to have the room to grow. We're a museum that constantly is growing as far as artifacts are concerned and visitorship is concerned, and we just didn't have the space to do it beforehand. Now we have a brand new building, built from the ground up, custom-made for us, and it is exponentially filled more than ever was before with both physical and digital interactivity.
Right.
Lots of ways. Look, museums, all of us can tell you that people that go to museums learn in very different ways. Some people want to walk around and read labels and look at artifacts. Some people want to walk around and kind of grazers, just kind of see what looks interesting to them and go after
right.
it. Others want to touch stuff and actually want to be involved. And so we as a museum had to be sure to be something that would be accessible to all the different kinds of learners. So there are physical interactives where you do stuff, like crawling through air vents and hanging off of things like in the movies. There's digital interactives where we get very high level, like looking at how the brain works and how cognitive biases can sometimes bring us intelligence failure. And then we have something close to 60 films in the museum where we've talked to the people who were involved in particular operations or things like that, could kind of tell a little bit about how it was for them. So there are people, if you've got visitors that like to read, they're covered. You've got visitors that like to learn by film and other things, they're covered as well. And if you want to do stuff, not only do we have great interactivity, but we're planning more
right
as we move into the future.
You know, I assume your museum has people who are all about acquisitions. They're out trying to find more material that might, and you're one of them.
Yeah.
Is there the holy grail when it comes to spy stuff that you've been looking for years and you can't get your hands on?
Well, the holy grails tend to be things that we think are gone, right? I mean, because intelligence is not something where, unlike some other American, you know, kind of milestone moments where the Smithsonian's there waiting for to take it from you when you're done, right? Mm-hmm. Or like the Baseball Hall of Fame, right? Somebody hits a milestone home run, literally the Hall of Fame's there like, can I have your bat, please?
Yeah.
In many cases, they're wonderful artifacts that end up at the bottom of the ocean or destroyed or burned or other things like that. So to me, the Holy Grail would be anything that we assumed had been destroyed or lost forever that pops back up again.
And is the Cold War era sort of the era that you guys tend to focus on? Because that's the, I think of as the height of the romanticism that might surround spying.
Sure, that was the old museum. And not that we ignore it, we have lots and lots and lots of Cold War stuff in the new museum. But we made a permanent, very purposeful effort to become more chronologically diverse than we had been before, more geographically diverse than we had before.
Because you focused too heavily maybe on the Cold
War? Yeah, I think we were kind of looked at as the U.S., British, Soviet, Cold War, World War II museum before this. Yeah. Now we have stories from every continent but Antarctica, stories going back to the ancient period, stories going all the way up to the modern day, which is not that easy to do when you're talking about intelligence, right? Yeah. Stuff's classified. We wanted to make a point to, no matter who you are, where you're from, or what kind of period you're interested in, there's something for you there.
Catherine, how about the National Geographic Society? How have you kept up with the times?
Well, I think two things. One sort of on the technical side and then another on the content side. On the technical side, technology and storytelling is just changing so dramatically. There's so many different ways to capture video, VR, AR, all these different platforms and mapping technologies, and National Geographic has been making maps forever. So there are all these interesting ways to capture content and transform that content into storytelling. So
I was going to say, back in our neck of the woods, both the Harry Truman Museum and the Dwight Eisenhower Museum have been closed in recent months, all for upgrades and updates is what we're talking about here.
Right. So our photographers and storytellers are really, it's such a wonderful time for them because there's so many choices. But I would say on the content side, we've spent, you know, over a century documenting the wonders of the world, right? All these cultures from around the world, and that's kind of been the brand promise of National Geographic. And in recent years, we're really trying to take that capital that I think we've built in people's trust and sort of turn towards trying to inspire people to care more about the planet. We see a lot of problems in the world and a lot of threats to the beauty of our planet. And so we're trying to use these stories to educate people about what's happening.
Is that because there's a sense that everyone now has pretty much seen the world? It's been pretty fully explored. We got Robert Ballard coming across the Titanic. I mean, there aren't many places left that haven't been seen.
I think that's partially true. I mean, we are constantly exploring and discovering new things, and technology is a big part of that. But I do think that you're right. I mean, the society was founded during a time when a lot of places on Earth hadn't been reached.
Right.
And there was a huge, huge passion for doing that. Now that we've been there, what can those places teach us about what's going on the planet and how those changes are impacting people? So we are focused a lot on that. And we're directing a lot of our content and storytelling towards trying to educate people.
Vince?
I just wanted to say that if the content is good, like the three museums represented here have just fantastic content, then you can be very creative in the kind of the mechanism you use to get that point across, what technology you can use. It's really just a conduit to the public. If your content's bad, I don't care what technology you have, how whiz-bang it is.
Right.
It's going to fall flat on its face. And so I think the three of us are in museums where we can have fun with the technology because the content itself stands alone. And we can just find the different mechanisms and conduits to make it more entertaining for the public. Because we do have fantastic content.
And there's a real art in what you're talking about. It's easy to talk about, but there's a real science and a real art in trying to achieve what you're describing here, Vince.
Well, and that's why there are programs, graduate student programs, that are focused on museum studies. Okay. And there are whole companies out there that are design firms that focus on museums, because it's not just something that anybody can do. And that's not my background. I've learned this on the job. I'm a historian. And I'm just amazed at the people who do museum stuff for a living, about how complicated it is.
Yeah. I remember a few years ago, the National World War I Museum opened up, and Ralph Applebaum, a famous museum curator and exhibitor, helped design that, as he did the museums out in Washington after 9/11. And my kids, it was a snow day, and my kids were with us as the museum opened up. And as Ralph was on the air talking with me, my kids were out walking around the museum. And as soon as the show ended, Ralph was interviewing my kids. What did you touch? Where did you go? What did you see? He really wanted to know how all that worked.
The last thing you want is someone leaving your museum remembering a technology, right, or remembering some whiz-bang thing. You want people leaving your museum remembering the content of the museum. Because if they remember just how cool some gadget or game was, then they're really, that's, you failed, I think, as a museum.
It's all about the story.
What draws many visitors to museums in the first place, I think, is that chance to have a close encounter, a one-on-one experience with an authentic object, something real. Mm-hmm. And so it's sometimes a little easy for us to let digital surrogates get in the way of that close encounter or that authentic experience. So you need that mix of approaches, I think.
Well, what do you guys after at the National Postal Museum? What do you want to see displayed in the next couple of years?
You know, one of the stories I think that we need to tell is about how much of the e-commerce world that we're experiencing now all functions along a system and a kind of a grid line, a pattern that the Postal Service pioneered in living memory. The whole creation of delivery networks and barcoding and OCR technology and all those sorts of things were all developed initially under contracts for the Postal Service, and that have sort of enabled all of the e-commerce and parcel post experience, the boom that we're all living through now.
Well, we're going to have to leave our conversation there, and it was a good one. I want to thank Daniel Piazza. You just heard his voice, the chief curator for the Smithsonian National Postal Museum, Vince Houghton, historian and curator for the International Spy Museum, and Catherine Keene, vice president of public experiences for the National Geographic Society. Thanks for taking time with us today. I sure appreciate it.
Great to be
thank
here.
You.
Yesterday on the show, University of Missouri System President Moon Choi described the university's next-gen health initiative. Find that and other previous episodes. Also, our conversation with David Brooks from the New York Times yesterday. You'll find all of them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, NPR's social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam on viewing news through the lens of the social sciences for our second day live from NPR studios here in Washington. We hope you'll join us for that. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.